Desert Island Books on NHR in association with NUH Library Services.
Now, we're delighted on NHR to welcome back onto the station Barbara Cathcart, who has a very long association with Nottingham Hospital's charity. Welcome back, Barbara. Good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes, it's 10 years. I checked the old emails and it's 10 years since you were last with us. First of all, tell us about what you do and what you have been doing at NUH over the years.
What have I done for the last 10 years or more? So I'm the chief executive of Nottingham Hospital's charity. We raise funds and receive funds for the benefit of patients at the hospitals. We look after it really well with a board of trustees, a separate governance structure, and we make grants across the hospitals. And in the time I've been in this job, we have granted almost £60 million to the hospitals. And interestingly, I'm looking at something that we have gifted to Nottingham Hospital's radio, which are these bespoke, Boffin-made devices that go on to wards so that people can listen to your radio station.
Yes, and thank you so much for your support. Barbara is talking about some of the Wi-Fi radios designed by our very own Boffin, Mr. Steve Colby, who is our program controller, and many other things at NHR. And we were talking off air beforehand, actually, Barbara and I, about how successful this particular project has been, especially on some of the wards which perhaps might not have had much entertainment in recent times. Some of the wards where there are some dementia patients, for example, have had these radios in operation on the bays and have been really successful. When we were talking about that, how music cuts through a lot of things, did you have any experience of that yourself? Do you?
I just want to say something on the Boffin word. I just love some English words which are unique to this country, and I say that in a very endearing, flattering way, so I hope I haven't misused it in any
no,
way.
No, it's a perfect word.
It's a compliment to the creator of these boxes that I'm looking at.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Anything that, you know, brings music and cheers people up is good in my book. So, yeah.
That will be a compliment for Steve, don't
worry.
Yeah,
good, good. I hope so. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, but we're just talking about how music can cut through even the loss of most of one's memory. It seems to reactivate some people.
Yeah, I just heard on, if I can say, Radio 4.
You can say that.
There was a study done in Finland, I think it was, where different music activates different parts of people's bodies. I don't know if you heard it, but it said like they played ABBA, and ABBA activated the legs and hands and made people want to dance. And then they played Adele, and it activated the chest, like the heart. So it's the first time they had actually recognize that music actually activates different parts of your body when you're listening to it.
That I did not know. That's a little bit more specific than I'd been aware of. I always remember I think it was a YouTube video from years ago where there was an elderly former, I think she was a Russian ballerina, and she was in a wheelchair and she was quite immobile, really, head down. But when the right piece of ballet music was played, the arms came out, all the movements came up, the head came up, and it was a transformation. It was just quite magical.
But this study could perhaps partially confirm that.
Yeah, yeah.
Where that came from. Yeah.
Fabulous. Anyway, they're doing great. So thank you again for your support with our Wi-Fi radios from our special Boffin, Steve Colby. Give him another plug. But yes. So you've been with Nottingham Hospital's charity for very many years. You must have been involved in so many different projects. Do you have a few that come to mind that are a little bit different, or have you taken part yourself in some of those?
Yes. So were you aware that I'm actually retiring in March?
It's on the grapevine.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So I actually have been asked this. I don't want to get tedious in my answers, but my answer is like I can't choose my babies.
Yeah.
Because like if you were to ask me that every year, I'd maybe have a favorite one from the year. But given that it's been 17 years, so it was 17 years since the two hospitals, City Hospital and Queen's Medical Center, merged, and I was the person who was tasked with merging those charities and all the governance that went around with it. So there have been a lot of projects, so really big ones, like creating the Cystic Fibrosis Center at the city campus. Recently, the intraoperative MRI at Queen's, like those are kind of really big ones in the millions. Then there's the Pediatric Sexual Assault Center here at Queen's, which was to make that sterile environment patient-friendly just in the configuration of the spaces, and then went on to create an on-site video conferencing suite for the police so that the children would not have to separately go to a police station. So those are kind of like the really big ones I can think of. 3D color CAT scans, one on each campus. There are breast cancer equipment, reconfiguration of spaces and patient areas, many staff rooms. During COVID, a lot of extra psychological support. Then there are all the clinical excellence training and development. Not training, I like to say development because training is basic, but development is a step beyond. A lot of investment in nursing, laterally mentoring for medics, and then small little radio transmitters.
As you say, it's a bit like choosing your favorite child, isn't it? From and what a lot of children over 17 years.
It's a lot of grants.
Yes, a lot of grants. As you say, £60 million.
Yeah.
It's such a huge contribution you and the hospital charity have made. So thank you to all of you and your team. Tell us a little bit about
your... I was about to say, it's not about me.
I was going to ask you about your team, so tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, this is all about my team, and don't forget our board as well. Mm-hmm. So my team is a special... Absolute special mention has to go to Julie Brailsford, who is was my original one and only deputy director of finance, but she's like the goddess of everything, all operations and governance issues and HR. She just basically is a font of all knowledge and lovely with it. But she is actually an accountant, a qualified accountant. So she is the director of finance. So she heads up the finance function. And given the fact that we are the recipients of anything from £3 to £6 million in a year, all that has to be absolutely audited, going to the right funds and the right time and the right place, all accounted for and scrutinized by the various factions of, you know, charity commission and audit committees. And so special mention, knowing money's in good hands with Julie, reporting to me and our board. Then there's Nigel Gregory, who's the newcomer, who's been with us for 8 years, instead of Julie's 16, and he has headed up the development function. So a lot around all the fundraising, the marketing, the communications, all the branding that I think has increased the profile of the hospitals in the community. Mm-hmm. And he has just been successful in being appointed as my successor as the CEO.
Right.
Then under them, there's the finance team that does all the, as I said, all the accounting. Then there's the fundraising team, who are incredibly motivated to get out there and meet people and hold events and go out into the community and tell people about what we do and raise funds like that. And the comms supports that function.
Yes, I'm sure you've had a lot of support, obviously, in the team over the years, and I'm sure a lot of people would love to thank you in person, but a general thanks from all you've managed to help over the years, Barbara and team. Okay, so I just for those people who may not know your origins, they might have spotted that it's not the strongest Nottingham accent.
No.
So could you share a little bit about where you hail from then?
Yeah, I can't even pretend to do a Nottingham accent. I can say that when I first moved here, if I hear a really pronounced Nottingham accent, I didn't actually understand what people were saying to me. So it took a while.
I can believe that.
It took a while. I think, well, I have a Canadian accent because I am Canadian. I think Canadian accents generally are more generic. They don't have that breadth of accent variation, very subtle. And even the whole continent of North America, like I'm constantly being asked what part of America I'm from. And it actually doesn't insult me because I understand no one would hear the difference. The only time I find it annoying is when I say I have a Canadian accent and they go, oh, I have an auntie in Mississauga or an uncle here. And I think, well, then why didn't you ask me if I was possibly Canadian? That's the only time it bothers me. It's like, well, you do know that there is another country with this accent. So
it's a pretty big country as well, to be fair.
Yeah. And the accent actually is different if you know what you're listening to. But yeah, I'm from Montreal in Canada. That's where I grew up. And then people say, well, do you speak French? That's the next question.
Mm-hmm. I
don't know what the latest percentage is, but I think Quebec is 80% French. But the other 20% originally was English. Demographics could have changed.
Right.
So I'm in the minority English one, but yes, I did grow up speaking French. And then I went to university in Toronto. So then I had another, you know, so I'm sort of, I've lived in two main places in Canada. Mm.
So the Canadian giveaway, there's a particular sound. I gather it is to do with words like a boat.
Yeah. So I think it's the Scottish origin of right. English Canada. And I think if I make it strong, it's like out. Instead of out. So an American out. Would say out. And we say out.
Yes.
So it's sort of out and about.
Out and about. Oh, I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So that's how that's sometimes to if you're not sure about whether someone's Canadian or American, if you listen long enough to hear the OU, then you'd go, oh, okay, I thought you were Canadian. And I think the Canadian accent also is it's just a tiny bit softer, or just maybe it's just how the way people the intonation rather than accent. I think, yeah, I think it's a little bit less nasal.
Right. I'm just fascinated with accents. I could talk to you all day about accents. But anyway, you're very welcome. And we are actually going to move on to the main topic of this feature, which is Desert Island Books. So are you much of a reader?
Yeah, I'm a big reader. I'm never without at least a book on the go, ever. Like, I'm just never not reading something. But I don't always remember what I've read. I don't always remember the author's name, but I remember most of the stories. Like sometimes I'll just randomly remember a story and think I don't remember what book that was from. But yeah. My head is full of stories.
Yeah, well, don't worry, we can remind you. But for someone who reads a lot, it must be quite hard to narrow it down to five books and maybe one that you haven't read.
Yeah, it was hard.
Yeah. Okay. You are going to get on that desert island. What is the first book you would take on there?
So I remember the first one that I said was A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway. And the reason I chose that book, I think, is, I remember reading a lot of books at that age. I think it was the romance of, it wasn't very romantic, it was the First World War, but the romance of Catherine, who's the main female character in that story, and how she was a nurse in the tragedy of her surroundings and fell in love with someone. And it was a real love story against this terrible background. But my grandmother was a nurse in the First World War as well.
Wow, okay.
In Liverpool. And I remember her nursing stories and the things she must have seen. But I think it was more just the exoticism of it that appealed to me. And it was just a very different setting in Italy in the First World War. And I was in Montreal in the winter. And just the description of the things that were going on around her at the time. But it was, and I think it was, yeah, it was the also Hemingway's writing was very different because it's so sparse yet so descriptive. So he he's known for that, but you really do notice when you read his writing how much he conveys with so few words, not like me right now.
It's not comparable. I go around the houses to get to a very simple point usually. Did you know your grandmother well?
Oh, yeah, I did know my grandmother, yeah. Yeah, she I mean, that had been a long time. I mean, she was really young at that point. So when I knew her, she was very old. And she was Scottish, actually. So
I was going to ask you to do a Scouse accent.
No, she had a Scottish accent. And yeah, I really liked my grandmother. She taught me how to make scones on the what she called the girdle. Which I have inherited. Yes.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah, right. It's a griddle. It's a girdle.
A girdle. Like that's something totally different from my memory.
Yeah, well, that's what it was called. That's in Scotland at her time. So anyway, I have it at home, and I still know how to make these scones without a recipe.
Fabulous. Scones debate, that's for another time. So A Farewell to Arms, then, by Ernest Hemingway, is your first choice on the island. Thank you very much for telling us something about the reasons behind that as well. Okay, book number two is Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy.
Yeah.
Tell us about this one.
So Anna Karenina, I thought I should read War and Peace. I thought I wanted to read War and Peace. So I started War and Peace and I got to about 200 pages and I thought, I'm really not enjoying this. Also, it is so complicated reading a Russian novel. You have to have a list about who they're actually referring to, because each person, I think they're called patronyms, but each person can be known by four names. So like you think that someone is being referred to in one name, but in Russian they can have three names and it becomes really complicated. So all of a sudden four characters, you're dealing with like 16 names. I am exaggerating, but they do have more than one name and they're also foreign names. So it's quite hard to keep track of who everyone is. And the longer the novel and the bigger it is, then the more and more names there are.
Without distracting you, does that apply to anyone, male or female? They could have as many as four versions of the name.
Yeah, I don't know if it's four. I could be exaggerating, but it's definitely two or three.
Right.
And then they have their nicknames. So it is quite complicated when you've got a dense novel with a lot of characters. I mean, this is stupid because I mean, a lot of people have read War and Peace. So, you know, this was just my issue with it. And also half of it's about war. Mm-hmm. So you've kind of got the salon scenes and all the personal intrigue, and then you'd get the war scenes. So given the fact that it's probably 1,000 pages long and half of it was war, I just thought, you know what, I'm really not enjoying the war side of this on top of keeping on track of all these characters. Like, I'm losing the will a bit. So I thought, well, that's going to be a deficit in my knowledge gap if I don't read Tolstoy. So then I thought, okay, I'll read Anna Karenina.
Mm-hmm.
Anna Karenina, you know, it didn't have war scenes, so it was all salon.
I was going to say, less war.
Yeah, it was all salon, all gossip, all, you know, women all done up with their, you know, straight-laced and basically barely allowed out of the house, having to behave in such defined strictures that their social class at the time required of them. And they were absolutely ruled by their husbands. I mean, they're treated like pets, really. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do this and you can't do that. And poor Anna Karenina just burst out of it and had to give up her child to have this affair with the man she loved. And it all went terribly wrong. And it was really sad. But I enjoyed the sort of Russian dark drama of it all. It was it's not like literature. It's not like English literature. It's clearly Russian. It's clearly different. So I found it enjoyable, but quite cloying. It's quite claustrophobic feeling.
How would you define that difference then between sort of Russian literature generally and other literature? Is that one of the aspects of the darkness of it? Or?
Well, I'm hardly an expert on that. I mean, I have read a few other Russian things. Chekhov. I love Chekhov as well. Mm-hmm. It just feels like, my word is dark, dramatic, heavy, psychological. Yeah, it's not light in any way.
Yeah, the only thing, I mean, I don't read a lot of literature full stop, unfortunately, but I'd like to. But with Russian music that I've come across, there's a lot of melancholy in that. So I just wonder whether that's just like a generic thing that's been passed on down the generations.
Well, the other thing that I was thinking, the difference was I've always been interested in Russia because geographically it's so aligned with Canada, mm-hmm. but politically it's so different. So it's just so interesting to me that two places that look the same in terms of their natural resources, their magnitude, their forests, their tundra, their cold climate, like all the things that you would think would make them have a lot in common. There's really not very much in common between them at all. And between the west end of Canada and the east end of Russia, there's just the Bering Strait, which is, you know, just this little piece of water that separates them. That was enough, I guess.
Yes, well, very similar and very different. Okay, that's book number two then, Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy. So we'll move on to book number three on the list, which is by Ted Hughes. It's called Birthday Letters. Can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, well, I was kind of fascinated with the incredible literary duo of Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. Their story and their kind of combined literary genius, and also by their relationship. And I think that Ted Hughes has caused a lot of controversy because he was clearly at best unkind, I think, to his wife, who really suffered from significant mental illness. Sometimes I think about these writers like Sylvia Plath or Virginia Woolf. If they'd been alive today, would they have been on some form of antidepressants and therapy and not have suffered the way they had to the point of suicide? Not that everyone is okay these days, but just I wonder if they would have received help, the difference that they would have made to them personally and even maybe to their writing. But anyway, I mean, his poetry is incredible to me. I mean, his description of nature as well is really quite profound. And also his understanding his maybe not understanding human nature, but his description of human relationships I found quite dense and fascinating. So after she did commit suicide, over time, he wrote birthday letters as a commemoration to her and her life. And it was just so full of love and insight about who she was and what she liked, and got such a good feel for her as a character. But, you know, as I said, I don't know what his motivations were in writing that. I mean, was it guilt? Was it longing? Was it didactic? Was it just wanting to get some memory down? But the poems themselves are really beautiful, and they do tell a story. So each poem is a small story in itself, and collectively it tells a story of their relationship.
I think sometimes when you're looking at the work of artists, whatever art they partake in or were involved in, sometimes it's important to kind of separate the art from the artist, because otherwise you can find yourself refusing to acknowledge or appreciate something because of some of the personal story, perhaps. And obviously, different stories will affect people in different ways, but it sounds like a very powerful set of poems.
But that's the whole thing, isn't it? To separate the art from the artist, because that's quite controversial now, because there are artists who did despicable things.
Yes.
And how do we feel about them? Yeah, their art is still amazing, but then when you know the fuller story, it kind of influences how you feel about it, and should it, and what should we do about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it a bit like, you know, perceptions of Rome, you know, the Roman Empire. People glory in the memory of Rome, but there were a lot of despicable things that happened.
Oh, many.
So, I think it's a case by case, mm-hmm. perhaps. So I don't think we can stick them all in the same basket. Okay, so that's Ted Hughes' Birthday Letters. You mentioned the descriptions of the natural world.
Yes.
And just a slight aside on this, I know that you are a a lover of nature yourself, and you walk a lot. Hiking is one of your things. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to get maybe a couple of thoughts and memories of some of the beautiful places that you've visited with your own kind of nature walks or what have you.
So I love being outdoors and I love nature, but I am by no means a nature specialist. So I can't name all the species of butterflies or fungi that I'm looking at, but I am an absolute lover of being outdoors. And I think in England, obviously, all the places that people know are, on a beautiful day, some of the most stunning places on earth. Like, yeah. I wouldn't need to be anywhere else except in this country. I could never leave this island if I could experience it in the best weather it has to offer.
That is a slight ride.
But that is the problem, you know. That's why I think why we all tend to leave in the summer, because we want to be guaranteed good weather. But on the, you know, so, and also I have climbed Mount Snowdon and Ben Nevis twice, Mount Snowdon once, all in sunshine in April.
Oh. Like,
so, you know, you just don't know when it's, I mean, April in Snowdon was hot. So you just never know. So I'd say, you know, the Lake District and the areas of Snowdonia, which has a new name, a Welsh name, which I won't attempt to say, the west coast of Scotland, Norfolk by the Sea, Southwest Pass of Cornwall. I've walked all these places and the paths around it. That's within the UK, which is, as I say, you'd never have to leave. On a clear day in Cornwall, the water, you could actually look down at the sea and think you're in Greece. So those are some. And then my husband and I have tended to do hut-to-hut walks on the GR10 in the Pyrenees. So we're kind of working our way from west to east in the Pyrenees. So that's pretty spectacular. And the Pyrenees are very different from the Alps, because they're more remote. They just, they have a very different feel. They feel more like the end of the world. And then, obviously, Switzerland, you know, kind of tops the list for this Jungfraujoch walk. There's sort of a bowl that you can do, which takes in all the famous range.
Quick question, did you yodel?
No, but it was really weird, because we were walking towards one of our huts, and we heard this really weird noise, because bearing in mind it's pretty much in the wilderness, we heard this really weird noise as we were approaching our destination, our hut for the night, and we came to a lake, and someone was actually playing an alpine horn on the lake.
Right.
And so it was a very haunting sound without understanding what it was until we actually saw it.
Wow, special moment. Okay, so that relates to Birthday Letters by Ted Hughes. That's Barbara's third choice for her Desert Island books. Number four on your list is Living Under the Apple Tree by Alice Munro. What can you tell us about this one?
So this is a collection of short stories by Alice Munro. Who is a really well-known short story writer. She and Carol Shields are two of the famous Canadian short story writers. Everyone thinks of Margaret Atwood. Margaret Atwood also writes short stories, as we probably all know. But Alice Munro did win a Nobel Prize for Literature for her short stories. And just, I can't obviously comment on any one of them specifically, but she has an incredible way of seeing right into the heart of a character and conveying that very quickly. I mean, the thing about short stories is they're telling a story that, if done well, you're engaged and with that person for sometimes like only 20, 25 pages. So the technique and the mechanism an author must use to get you hooked on someone so quickly and au fait with what it is that they're confronting and dealing with is really interesting. And she just does that story after story, and each one is unique. And you know, they can have a twist in them where you see something in the beginning of a story which by the end of the story has a completely different complexion just because of a few sentences in the middle that just twist your thinking around about that person.
Okay, so that's Living Under the Apple Tree by Alice Munro. Question on writing. Have you ever been a writer yourself? And have you ever tried creative writing yourself?
Well, yes, in the past. I haven't lately. But yes, I have been involved with different writing groups and written some things, yeah.
I don't know, I just sensed that you had maybe a little secret passion there.
Yeah, maybe when I stop working, I'll do it more again. I had a little modicum of success when I did it, but I found if you're working full-time and you have a family and you're writing, then the thing of sending it out, see, I just said out.
You did, I made you self-conscious, didn't I?
<Yeah. laughs> then you... I think you have to choose between like sending it all out versus just writing it. So I never really got to the point of sending it out. But the little bits that I did, I had a little bit of success. But then for whatever reason, I lost my muse and I stopped. And my husband keeps saying, you need to start writing again. So I think I'm quite sure that I probably will again, because they say that, you know, to be a writer, you have to be a reader. So I would say all writers are readers, but not all readers are writers.
Yeah, well, good luck in that. I think hopefully you'll have a little bit more time to indulge in that now. When you hang up your charity boots, I'm sure you'll still be involved in some capacity. Okay, so moving on to book number 5 for you is My Mother Laughs by Chantal Ackerman. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, that's a real twist, that one. Never heard of that author before. And the book was given to me by my son, and I think he just gave it to me because of the title, because he actually does really make me laugh. We laugh a lot. I think most of the time he's probably laughing at me, but that's okay because he's my son. But it's not a funny book at all. It's actually a really difficult book. It's about a relationship between a mother and daughter, and the mother is a Holocaust survivor. So she obviously carries a lot of trauma, and her daughter does as well. And it is about their relationship and the depth of mother-daughter relationships and the things that pass between them, and the spoken and unspoken communication between them doesn't have a happy ending. There's not a lot of laughter in it, but it's a little bit like how I started off this description of Hemingway. It's quite sparse in the words it uses, so you look almost between the words about what's being conveyed. And I think, I haven't looked lately, but I think the author is Belgian-American. So she has that a very specific link to the Holocaust. I mean, mm-hmm. She wasn't removed. Her mother had been right at the center of it. So that also adds another complexity.
Yeah. Okay, so that's My Mother Laughs by Chantal Ackerman. Talking of family, do you want to share something about your family? Give them a mention.
Yeah, I have two kids, and they're grown up, and they're both well-educated and successful and happy and amazing. And, you know, we all see each other a lot. One's in Bristol, one's in Rotterdam.
Okay, great. Now, we've got your 5 books that you know and want to take with you onto the island. You have the opportunity to take one extra book that you haven't read. Can you tell us about what you would take?
Right, okay. So I haven't read Homer's Odyssey, and I think I would like to read that because it must be kind of the mother of all stories, and I haven't read it yet, and I think it would be really engrossing and engaging, and would sort of set the scene for literature that came later. I mean, I know there was literature before then, but I suppose in terms of our Judeo-Christian European model, which is what I've been reading, to be fair, hopefully I would see sort of some seminal parts of where that had originated, and also just the story behind it. It's quite a long, wrangling tale, so I'm thinking it would keep me engaged for quite some time.
Yeah, it's pretty long, I think.
I think he gets home in the end.
Homer's Odyssey. Are you a Shakespeare person as well?
I could not profess to be a Shakespeare expert in any way whatsoever. But I mean, you know, through school and since then and going to Stratford several times, I've seen the, you know, the main ones and some more obscure ones. I think what the RSC does really interestingly is they keep placing Shakespearean plays in modern settings. Mm-hmm. And I just find that's really incredible. And also, how many times have you seen a series or something and it's described as being Shakespearean? Or sometimes in life, you know, you'll say, oh, that's very Shakespearean. If there's like a real tragedy or some kind of terrible conflict or betrayal, then I am reminded of something I've read. Like, as an example, this is a weird example, but in Othello, when he has Iago as his deputy, sort mm-hmm. of, and sometimes I think in terms of the modern, of just of the workplace, like he's called Honest Iago, but really he's going against his person the whole time. So I just always think, yeah, there are these traits, of these character traits that surpass time. And that's what Shakespeare's known for. So, I mean, I know enough just to sort of say that.
I think you know quite a bit if you've seen as much as you have. But, yeah, I agree that one of those aspects of the timeless and the universal, those mm-hmm. those human characteristics that you think, well, things have changed so much, and yet these things haven't in so many ways. So, fascinating stuff. But your extra book will be The Odyssey by Homer. And I'm sure you'll spend plenty of time reading that one. As you said, it's quite a long one. But that's great. Thank you so much for your selection of books, Barbara. Now, it is NHR. And on NHR, we do like to try and extract some music from our guests as well. So what would you like to choose?
I must admit, for more reasons than one, I do really like Joni Mitchell.
Okay.
So, a Joni Mitchell song.
All right. Barbara Cathcart, thank you so much for coming in to NHR again, 10 years later, and for all of your work at NUH Charity and 17 years of a lot of effort and a lot of friendships and relationships and support for endless causes. So thank you for all you've done, and thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me.
As promised, here's some Joni Mitchell, but there's a lovely little family twist. This is an extract of Circle Game, performed by Barbara's daughter, Athlyn. Enjoy.
Painted ponies go up and down. We're captive on a carousel of time. You can't return, you can only look behind from where we came and go round and round and round in a circle game.
Desert Island Books on NHR. In association with NUH Library Services.